Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 16th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Last weekend, Lyndon LaRouche said that the situation around President Obama is beginning to smell like Nixon, calling it Obama's Watergate moment. He was referring, on the one hand, to the escalating series of scandals around the president, but even more so to events which are clearly visible on the horizon, which have the potential to of an earthquake, a political earthquake in the United States. The looming hyperinflationary collapse of the Eurozone, with its direct implications for the whole transatlantic financial system, including the United States, which is definitely not in a recovery. And secondly, President Obama's insistence on threatening Russia and China through his push for intervention in Syria under the unconstitutional doctrine of the right to protect, which could provoke World War III. Joining me for the first half hour on the program today to discuss this will be Jeffrey Steinberg, an editor of the Executive Intelligence Review and one of the leading counterintelligence experts in the world. You can visit the LaRouche Pack website to see a video with Jeff discussing this question in a video entitled Obama's Watergate Moment. So, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley. How are you doing?
Good. Let's get right into it. I'd like to start with these events just to run through them and then get to the broader strategic context. But it's definitely the case that even the mainstream media is saying Obama's had a tough couple of weeks. But what's the real story? What's going on that's undermining the sense of inevitability about a second term for Obama?
Well, I think that you've got a convergence of several crises that produced an absolute panicked reaction from the circles around Obama, both at the White House and in his campaign. And you've got to assume that when those kinds of frictional moments occur, the Obama personality, the Nero narcissist personality, compounds the magnitude of the hysteria and lashing out. And under those circumstances, they tend to make some egregious mistakes. So about a month ago, people will probably remember there was a kind of a pileup of things that backfired against Obama. You had this silly flap over same-sex marriage, which resulted in polls showing that suddenly Romney was getting more votes from women than Obama. And this is a key part of the Obama electoral strategy, is to maintain a substantial lead of support among women voters. So that caused a lot of panic. Then they went on the attack against Romney over Bain Capital, and half the Democratic Party leaped to Romney's defense because they all depend on money from Wall Street funds, very much like Bain Capital. So you had Steve Rattner, a big bundler for the Democratic Party. You had the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, Cory Booker, a sort of a young African-American up-and-comer in the party. Governor Deval Patrick of Massachusetts, and then finally, former President Bill Clinton on CNN.
Yeah, this brought the whole Clinton, it made it evident that there was a continuing friction between Clinton and Obama.
Right, and my reading is that at that point, the campaign apparatus panicked, and directly in consultation with Obama, they decided we have to launch an offensive to present Obama as a successful president. Well, how do you do that when he hasn't succeeded in anything? It's very simple. They said, we're going to start leaking out information about secret programs and, you know, big national security tough guy successes by Obama. So they leaked out details that compromised an ongoing Saudi-British penetration of the Yemeni circles of Al-Qaeda by boasting that they had managed to get a copy of one of the new designer bombs that was being planned to be used to blow up American airliners. Secondly, they put out the story about Obama's Tuesday afternoons selecting target lists of people to be assassinated by drones and by American hit squads, whether they're American system, American citizens or not. Then you had the leak of the Obama claiming credit for the Stuxnet virus. Well, you know, ironically, the Israelis quietly said about Stuxnet, well, you know, you really didn't do it. It was us. And, of course, nobody really made a big deal of it, but it wasn't a CIA operation that got that Yemeni al-Qaeda bomb. It was a Saudi intelligence guy who penetrated the group working along with the British, and we shared the results. So even the leaks themselves were boastful and exaggerated, but nevertheless, vital ongoing national security operations were leaked out needlessly and jeopardized the lives of who knows how many people, cost us massive amounts of money, and compromised major national security operations. And
Jeff, wasn't this, I mean, there are two sides to this, because this was, the leaks were an attempt to make him look good, courageous, that he's a manager of the war on terror, but it also showed the other side of him, which is the cold-blooded killer side.
They're so oblivious to reality that they only saw the upside of what was happening. They ignored the fact that these were major security leaks. And, of course, this is an administration that has prosecuted leakers who jeopardized the president's reputation using the Espionage Act, which is really like, you know, using a submachine gun to kill a fly. It's a complete fraud to be using that against government people who are legitimate whistleblowers who leak to American media rather than foreign intelligence agencies. But anyway, they're oblivious to reality. And I think a crucial point, which I made in the LPAC video that you just referenced, what they really failed to see is that, as was the case with Nixon, before Watergate, there was a broad bipartisan consensus that the guy had gone over the edge and was jeopardizing the republic. And I think that recently, really just in the past several weeks, you've had that kind of shift in attitude towards Obama, whether it's the kill lists or the drones or the stubborn refusal to address the real economic crisis. One betrayal after another, you now have an element of the Democratic Party not simply restricted to the Clinton group, but now much broader. Parts of the labor movement after Wisconsin have basically said this guy is a menace. And so that kind of shift opens the possibility, because he's committed so many high crimes and misdemeanors against the Constitution, to pave the way for his removal. And I think that, you know, when the leaks happened, there was a decision made among leading elements in the Senate as well as the intelligence community that this guy's just gone too far. And you've had recent polls, private polls that I've been briefed on, that indicate that the lack of enthusiasm for Obama does not translate into enthusiasm for Romney. In this poll, only 19% of the people who were interviewed said that they were satisfied with the choice between Obama and Romney, meaning that there's an outcry for some better option.
And we've seen this in the Democratic conventions that we've been attending, where you have a really lukewarm response at best to the president. They're more focused on local issues. And in fact, you have a number of senators who are saying that Obama should not even come into their state. And on the Republican side, I don't know if you were briefed on this, but in Louisiana and Texas both, you had near brawls at the Republican Party between the Ron Paul grouping, which actually did do a pretty good job of infiltrating the caucus system, and the Romney grouping. Now, Jeff, to take this to the next step, because you have the scandals are being discussed, especially the security leaks, that you mentioned the bipartisan side of that. But I think the other thing that Lyndon LaRouche is looking at, very much so, is what's happening right now in Europe.
Absolutely.
And that this is going to have a profound impact on Obama, the competent economic manager. Give us a quick update on what the situation is in Europe right now.
Well, there's been a decision made among the central banks and finance ministers of all of the G20 countries that they're going to attempt to save the euro, preserve the current system, which is really a British imperial monetarist global financial system, and they're now ready to plunge into the depths of collective Weimar hyperinflation. Every major central bank in the world, the big five, the Fed, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and the Swiss National Bank, have all, in a coordinated fashion, announced that they are prepared to launch a wall of money bailout of the big European private banks. If they go ahead with this, then you're entering on a global scale into the territory of October-November 1923 kind of Weimar hyperinflation. And the insanity of bailing out gambling debt is going to further tend to drive the momentum towards Glass-Steagall, which is the only option. Now, from Obama's standpoint, there's a very simple formulation that he has bought onto and which he's completely hysterical over. If Greece leaves the euro, and of course Sunday are the Greek elections, and you could very well have a left-wing coalition government that comes in committed to pulling the plug on the austerity deal and probably leaving the euro very soon and going back to the drachma. If Greece goes, then the euro as a whole goes, because there's no reason for any country to stay into the euro once the precedent has been established by Greece leaving, and when the only alternative is a 100% surrender of sovereignty. So,
well, Jeff, now on this point, so on the one hand, you have the demand that the nations of Europe give up their sovereignty and that they allow in their names a huge hyperinflationary debt be created to bail out the banks. Now, I want to get to the Obama side of this because he's saying, well, unless we get hit by something big in Europe, the economy in the U.S. is recovering. Isn't this Obama's policy? He's been, in fact, on these conference calls repeatedly urging this policy.
Sure, but you know the driving factor is if Greece goes, the euro goes. If the euro goes, Wall Street goes. If Wall Street goes, Obama goes. So from Obama's standpoint, at the end of that chain of events, he's desperately committed to making sure that one way or the other, Greece stays in the euro holds together, and that nothing blows up in his face before the November elections. He's not looking towards saving Europe or saving the United States. He's looking towards saving his reelection. And so he's desperate to hold the line, and therefore Geithner and Bernanke have a complete carte blanche to put the United States firmly behind the Europe bailout. Now, the U.S. banks, and this is widely known among people inside the European financial circles, particularly in the city of London, the big six U.S. banks that control like 90% of the assets in the U.S. banking system and hold a yeoman's share of global derivatives exposure. All of those banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and J.P. Morgan Chase, or one more I'm forgetting maybe, all of those banks are thoroughly exposed on the basis that they've bet on the survival of the euro. Mm-hmm. If the euro goes, then they lose massive amounts of money. What happened to J.P. Morgan Chase last month when they admitted they lost $2 billion on a bad bet out of their London office, what they were betting was that European bond yields would continue to go down because the ECB was committed to a hyperinflationary bailout backed up by the Fed. Well, some people blinked on that. J.P. Morgan lost big money. It's going to probably total closer to $30 billion than the $2 billion that Jamie Dimon admitted to. But that's typical of Wall Street. Wall Street is holding enormous credit default swaps where they make incrementally a nice amount of money as long as the European debt, sovereign debt, continues to be paid. So they're overexposed like crazy.
But then we saw the spectacle of President Obama praising Jamie Dimon.
Yeah, sure.
And praising J.P. Morgan Chase and saying, well, that's the nature of risk. And then also when Jamie Dimon was brought before the Congress, there was no serious questioning of him.
Well, because the bank the bank industry, the big Wall Street banks' lobbying operations have made it a point to especially control those people on the Senate Banking Committee and the House Financial Services Committee. It's shameless what goes on. But nevertheless, there is, in real-world terms, only one solution, and that's what Lyndon LaRouche has laid out repeatedly, and now there's a growing chorus of people who are saying, cut the garbage, the only option is Glass-Steagall. And that is the starting point for an economic recovery based on returning to a credit system and kick-starting the economy with NOAAPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance project, the biggest infrastructure project in human history. And so we're really at a break point. I spoke to Mr. LaRouche yesterday, and he said, look, we've crossed the threshold into the zone of hyperinflation, and that at this point we've got to deliver one clear message. No more bailouts. Stop before it starts. No more bailouts of this completely bankrupt European financial system and Wall Street. You're dealing with a situation in which you've got to go back to Glass-Steagall. The gambling debts are unpayable, and the more that you attempt to print money to pay those unpayable debts, the more you're guaranteed to have a blowout of hyperinflation, and this time it's not restricted to Weimar Germany. It's global. And it's centered in the transatlantic region where the greatest exposure is.
Now, you're listening to Jeffrey Steinberg. We only have a few more minutes with him. And I'd like to go into this other area where we're seeing bipartisan agreement emerge, which is Obama's unconstitutional decisions going back to Libya and what he's trying to do with Syria to impose this doctrine of right to protect, where we saw the UN ambassador from the United States, Susan Rice, last week saying that we don't even need to get any approval from anybody, neither the Congress nor the UN. The president has the right to intervene wherever he thinks there's a need to protect people from tyranny and atrocities. And, Jeff, we have the Webb bill. We have the Walter Jones bill. This is part of the equation on the recognition. Also, the Joint Chiefs of Staff moving against this, the recognition that this guy's gone over the edge, is it not?
Well, the crucial thing that you've got are Russia's arsenal of thermonuclear weapons. Putin has made it absolutely clear that the principle of national sovereignty is inviolable and that all of this R2P humanitarian interventionism is going to do is lead to thermonuclear war. Now, that puts a tremendous onus on the British financial oligarchy in the circles that pull the strings on Obama. Are they prepared to go nose-to-nose with Russia when Russia is openly saying that this is a red-line issue, we reject this wipeout of national sovereignty. We know it's directed against us. We know it's directed against China. And we put our thermonuclear weapons arsenal on the line that we're not going to tolerate this. So Obama's policy, the Susan Rice policy, flies in the face of what the Russians now openly refer to as the Putin Doctrine, which is the use of absolute military force all the way up to the level of thermonuclear weapons to assure that the system of national sovereignty centered around the United Nations Security Council is inviolable, that basically no acts of war can be undertaken, no humanitarian interventionism excuses for regime change can be undertaken except by consent of the UN Security Council. That's the structure that was created to defend the entire global system of world affairs. And the Russians are defending that to the hilt, and the British, Obama, Susan Rice, they're messing with something that they really don't want to mess with. The American Joint Chiefs of Staff, people like General Dempsey, are aligned with the Russians on this. But as long as the Russians hold firm, this move to end national sovereignty is going to be stymied.
Now, Jeff, let's pull this together then, because to have an impeachment or to have a removal of Obama, it will have to be bipartisan. I think we're seeing the sentiments in the population moving to the point where they're ready to accept that. But where will there be a motion in the Congress? You talk to people on Capitol Hill all the time. When do they go from shaking their heads and quietly saying, this guy's crazy, he's ruining everything, to publicly coming out and saying he's got to go?
Well, the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, and probably the Armed Services Committees in both houses also, are investigating these leaks. The FBI, under the direction right now at least of two U.S. attorneys from Washington, D.C. and Maryland, are investigating criminal misconduct in the leaking of these very, very damaging national security secrets. And last Friday, President Obama gratuitously called an impromptu White House press conference and basically expressed outrage that anybody would accuse him or his White House of being involved in the leaks. 2 days later,
That was his I am not a crook moment, huh?
Yeah, exactly. It's his Nixon walking into the cover-up trap moment. On Monday, Patrick Cadell, Democratic pollster, former top campaign person for Jimmy Carter, came out in an interview and said Tom Donilon, the president's national security advisor, was one of the parties deeply involved in this criminal leaking. Others have said that because it came from panic out of the election campaign, that you've got to also look at David Axelrod and Valerie Jarrett. Ultimately, it all leads to the Oval Office, and that President Obama himself was either directly in on or at least should have known what was going on with this and did nothing to stop it.
So, and Jeff, having Axelrod actually sit in on the meetings where Obama is deciding who's going to be killed and who's not going to be killed, Axelrod has no security clearance, does he?
No, and furthermore,
he's a political operative.
And he's not even in the government anymore. He left the White House to go back to Chicago to run Obama's reelection campaign. That's right. So, you know, this is the scandal that has the potential to be Obama's Watergate moment. Will it happen in time? Will it happen before, say, the Democratic convention? That's anybody's guess, but there's factors in motion now. John McCain is demanding an independent counsel. Next Monday, Eric Holder meets with Congressman Daryl Issa. He's desperate to avoid the scheduled contempt of Congress vote in the House Government Reform Committee scheduled for Wednesday the 20th. And I think it's important to sort of take a look at where things stand going into next week. Saturday is the Egyptian elections, and it's anybody's guess whether that situation will explode. Sunday is the Greek elections, mm-hmm. which could determine the fate of the euro and likely will. Monday and Tuesday is the G20 meeting in Mexico. Right. It's also the P5+1 meeting that takes place in Moscow. So major issues of the fate of the transatlantic financial system, the fate of the British oligarchical system, which is a better term, the fate of war and peace over Syria, Iran, all of these things are coming to a critical mass point over the course of the next 4 or 5 days. So we're at one of those rare historic moments where something profound is very likely to happen before the end of next week.
And in the middle of this, we have a president who is using classic public relations techniques to play up his strength as a killer.
Yep.
Well, Jeff, we're going to be talking in the next half hour with Keisha Rogers on politically what we have to get from the population to make sure the Congress doesn't flinch. Let me just ask you the last question for you. Is it your sense that there is a capability within the Congress to stand up at this moment, this rare historic moment, and live up to the traditions of this country?
Well, I think that's really the moral test of the Congress. And they've certainly shown a lot of spinelessness. But I think that there is a shift underway. We saw it on Glass-Steagall after the Jamie Dimon revelations, where there was a surge of support among, you know, what was a kind of a silent majority in the Congress. We've had a half a dozen new signatures on H.R. 1489 just since that Jamie Dimon announcement, and it's now up to 66 or 67 co-sponsors on the Glass-Steagall Reinstatement Act. If the evidence shows that senior White House officials were involved, or senior campaign officials were involved in orchestrating these leaks, then you are going to see a gang up against Obama, and you're going to see Obama react in Emperor Nero style. So we're going to be facing a profound political showdown moment and crisis. And I wish I could give an absolutely certain answer one way or the other, but I'm much more confident that we're headed for that kind of fundamental crisis of our republic. And we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that Congress has the spine to act to remove this guy.
Well, one thing that our listeners can do is they can take a look at the video that you did on this topic that's on LaRouchePack.com. They can email it out, send links out, make sure people are following this on LaRouchePack.com, because this is a moment where it's really in the hands of the people. And, you know, when you talk about the gutlessness of the Congress, you have to acknowledge that the people have tolerated this, have let it go on for a long time. Now that the American people are unhappy, they need leadership, and they ought to find it from LaRouchePack and our candidates. So, Jeff, thanks very much for joining us. I know you're very busy, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot, Harley.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
So now we'll turn to the Democratic nominee for Congress in the 22nd District of Texas, Keisha Rogers, who was facing a toothless gang that couldn't shoot straight in Fort Bendover County. They were trying to smear her and slander her because they didn't want the issues that Keisha was bringing out to be discussed, namely that Obama has to go and then we have some solutions. So, Keisha, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley. Hello.
I know you heard the last couple of minutes with Jeff. What we discussed with him was the convergence of crises, including the scandals around intelligence leaks, the Fast and Furious, and then also, importantly, the financial crisis that's hitting in Europe that's going to blow apart the whole global financial system. Now, you just did a taping of a TV program in Rome, Italy, where some of our collaborators in Italy wanted to make sure that they got out both the news of your victory, but also the fight for Glass-Steagall. How did that program go?
Well, during the program, what was made clear is that the only solution, the only issue on the table has to be the reinstatement of Franklin Roosevelt's 1933 Glass-Steagall policy. And what I iterated throughout the discussion was what Mr. LaRouche has made clear is that Glass-Steagall is not just a matter of a policy. This is a question of a commitment for the nation, a matter of survival. And as you were discussing before, and as we're continuing to see, the dam is breaking around Obama, and that is because we're looking at the breakdown of the entire transatlantic financial system, and hyperinflation is continuing to run rampant throughout Europe, and it's on its way to the United States, and people see it coming on quickly. And this hyperinflation is that of something much greater than people may have read about in their history books during the wheelbarrows and burning of money during the Weimar hyperinflation in Germany. And so the point that was gotten across during the discussion was, you know, where Europe is headed and how the United States, people in the United States, particularly around our national slate of candidates, is moving to intervene with the only viable solution to stop this collapse.
And in Italy, there is a group that's dealing with this crisis. You have, on the one hand, the president of Italy, Mario Monti, who's a creature of Goldman Sachs and the European bureaucracy, who's imposing a top-down dictatorship. On the other side, you do have our own colleagues in the LaRouche movement there, and I believe they just interviewed before you Senator Petrolini, who has a bill for Glass-Steagall before the Italian Senate.
That's right. And so one of the questions was, how is it that Glass-Steagall is going to be both fundamental for America, for the United States, and for Europe? And we're already seeing that people, leadership throughout Europe, is seeing the depths of the crisis continuing to become more dire and saying this is what we have to go with. And so, as you just said, yes, Senator Petrolini and in Italy has introduced a resolution in the Italian Parliament, and this is, you know, backing up what is already happening here in the United States, where now, as Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur introduced H.R. 1489, we already have 67 co-sponsors, and over the last week or so, that number has grown with an additional 5 to 6 co-sponsors signing on in just the last week. And I know you brought this up as you were discussing the moves of J.P. Morgan Chase and Jamie Dimon. But our job, and what has to be accomplished now, is to move rapidly toward increasing that number, doubling that number of co-sponsors to the H.R. 1489 bill.
Now, Keisha, this was one of the leading issues, or it should have been one of the leading issues in your campaign, except the clowns who were trying to stop you tried to do anything possible to prevent issues from being raised. And I think it's important that, I think the listeners know this already, but that you won the primary by sticking to impeaching Obama and going with Glass-Steagall, NOAPA 21, and a credit system. How did this resonate with the people who did vote? Did you have a sense that people really were being pulled to the polls because they wanted to send a message not just to Obama but to the rest of the world that, at least in the 22nd District, Democrats now twice in a row have shown that they'll support a candidate calling for Obama's removal?
I believe that that's the only reason that they were pulled to the polls, is that they saw a sense from us that there was a reason to fight, that there are solutions, and that what was being presented by the Democratic Party hacks and really on both sides was no real solution to address the crisis. And when we went to people's houses and told them, look, your only chance for survival and in the midst of this economic and financial breakdown is that you immediately come to understand Glass-Steagall and the importance of this. And we made Glass-Steagall during this campaign a household name, not only here in the United States, but we gave people a sense, or not only in the 22nd District, should I say, but we gave people a sense that they were participating in a fight that was being waged throughout the country and internationally. And so what happened during the campaign is that there was a real move, a real dirty operation to suppress the vote, to demoralize the voters, to say that there's nothing they can do about the collapse and there's nothing that can be done about the situation in which they find themselves. And so if it had not been for what we did to go out there and not only give the population a sense that there's a solution to the financial crisis, but more so what it is that we're going to do as the implementation of a real recovery plan, people can participate in the rebuilding of the nation again. They can participate in a mission, in great projects, similar to what President Kennedy intended and initiated during the Apollo mission and even after. And so what people went to the polls for is, yes, they wanted to send a message to the United States that they were ready to fight. Obama has to go. The population will not be destroyed by the likes of the British Empire and their drive toward hyperinflation or austerity. And, you know, they're finding themselves in a situation where people are being treated like cattle. And they decided, look, we're going to stand up and fight, despite all of the attacks that are coming out. And that's what we saw. But I have to say that we got to the point where the demoralization and the voter suppression that was set in was a big factor. And it was interesting that, you know, we won this election by a mere, you know, 106 votes. But that, I would have to say, was a principled 106 votes, because this showed that there are people out there who are still willing to fight and to stand up on principle, despite whatever popular opinion may say.
Keisha, I think one of the important points is that you talked about the voter suppression. Usually that's a code word from Democrats saying that Republicans are trying to intimidate African-American voters from going to the polls or Hispanic voters.
Right.
And yet this voter suppression, by turning the campaign into a nasty smear attack on you, was designed by the Obama campaign and by the supporters of Obama in Fort Bend County to suppress the Democratic vote. And in a sense, it worked, because it was extremely low turnout.
Exactly. It was a very low turnout. And, you know, in the last election, 2010 campaign, when we won the election with 53% of the vote, we probably had double the turnout from what we have in this campaign now. But as said, this is really showing that the population has not been given any type of idea that they have anybody fighting for them, that any one of the parties, especially the Democratic Party. And when you brought up the point of the African-American constituency, you know, they really tried to run a operation on African-American constituency, because, as you said, they ran a slander and smear campaign, and, you know, they said that I was a racist, or, you know, was anti-Semite,
they
or anything
you
else.
Called you a Ku Klux Klan member.
Ku Klux Klan member, I know, can you imagine? So this just demoralized people. I mean, this most definitely didn't make people go out and want to vote for my opponent. It made them want to stay home, and it suppressed their will to fight.
But I think there's the principle that you raised before is mm-hmm. that by going out and talking to people, now I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to our listeners, many of whom are somewhat cynical, they don't think you can win this fight. You know, they heard Jeff earlier talking about how we're at a moment now where Obama can be thrown out of office. And they start saying, yeah, but what about this, what about that? What you demonstrated with the handfuls of supporters you have here who are full-time activists is that if you go out and talk to people and convey to them that not only is there a chance to change it, but their very survival depends on taking action. You turned out almost 4,000 voters to the polls. Probably every one of them was there because of that message.
Exactly.
So our listeners should take this to heart, because we still have campaigns coming up in Detroit, and Washington State with Bill Roberts and Dave Christie. We also have the Rachel Brown campaign in Massachusetts. And then you're already on the ballot as the Democratic nominee for the election in November. So for those of the people who are listening who might fall back into their pessimism, their cynicism, their whining at the coffee pot or sitting in a bar bemoaning their fate, get off your rear end. This is the time where individual action makes a big difference. Now, Keisha, let me get to the other question that comes up around your candidacy, which is, again, one that they didn't want discussed. In 2010, it was impeach Obama, save NASA. NASA has gone through horrible attrition under Obama, deliberate destruction of NASA's manned space program and so on. Was this still an issue this time? Because they redistricted NASA out for the most part of your district, but there's still a lot of NASA workers who live in the district. Is this still an issue, and how did this play out in the election?
Yes, because this is not an election issue per se. This is a presidential issue. This is a national issue. And as a part of the federal, the slate of candidates, of LaRouche candidates, our intention and our driver is that we're spearheading a real scientific revolution. And it was clear that, you know, the redistricting after what we did in the 2010 primary, by making NASA, by making the science driver mission orientation for the nation the key to the campaign, and exposing what the anti-science Obama goons that said we're going to shut down the manned space program, shut down scientific research and development, exposing these guys and saying that this question of survival of the human species, not the question of survival of the 22nd District, the question of survival of the human species depends on us actually putting forth this a truly scientific revolution. And people knew that. People, you know, we had somewhere upwards of 10,000 plus people that were getting laid off from various institutions connected with NASA. And we were the only ones. People, you know, I had a contact, a young man today who said, or who sent me a email saying that, you know, I have to say, you're the only political candidate that came out to every single space event, NASA event there was. Even the candidate, even the congressman, Pete Olson, would only show up very periodically.
Well, this, your opponent, Olson, who claims that he was doing all he could to save NASA, essentially went along with Obama's dismantling of NASA.
Exactly, and was only concerned about, you know, having a retired shuttle here, not how are we going to actually proceed with the science driver program for a real space mission. So, yes, that program, that policy, was still a big part of my campaign, and even though they redistricted out for reasons that you know came really, I would say, straight from the White House, that you know they did everything in their power to put a stop to me. You know, not only did they redistrict out the space program or the NASA Johnson Space Center from the district, you know, you had redistricting out of various key skilled labor, industrial institutions, and areas within the district, which we had a lot of support in. But what we made clear is that when you run for, you know, this is a part of our national slate, when you're running for federal office, you're not running to represent a certain district. And if you just happen to have certain perks in your district, then that's what you fight for. NASA is a human issue. It's not a district issue. And when you're running to represent the nation, then you have to actually represent all people and the policies that you set and you represent are going to affect everyone.
Well, we're talking with Keisha Rogers on the LaRouche Show June 16th, I believe. Yeah, June 16th, 2012. Keisha is the Democratic nominee. And people can help your campaign. They don't have to live in the district. Where should people go if they want to find more about your campaign, see see some videos and make some contributions? Where do they go?
Oh, they can go to my website, and that is Kesha for Congress, K-E-S-H-A for Congress.com. And, you know, you can also give us a call here in the office, and I'd love to answer any questions. That is 713-830-9052. That number again, 713-830-9052.
And you can contribute because Kesha is going to be in the November election. Now, Kesha, let me just get to the last thing, to go back to what we started the program on with Jeff, the Watergate moment for Obama. One of the things that you did last weekend is you were at the Texas Democratic Convention, which pretty much corresponded to what we've seen with most of the Democratic conventions, which is a core of party hacks who are trying to figure out how to sustain some semblance of a political party. Demoralization about Obama, very small numbers of people attending, and yet they think they can turn, they can control things through such things as loyalty oaths. In both Texas and West Virginia, the Democratic Party passed something saying that you have to support the president to be considered a Democrat, and on that basis they said that Kesha is not a Democrat, Democrats mm-hmm. should not support her. And there were several people who were trying to throw you out of the convention. But you also had other people who came up to you covertly and congratulated you. You addressed a couple of conventions, a couple of caucuses. What was your sense overall of the mood in the Texas Democratic Convention?
The sense was that we have a dying party that really has gone away, as we've been expressing for quite some time, from that true tradition of the party of President Franklin Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy, and they've allowed for the Wall Street interest controlled by Obama and his Wall Street and British backers to run rampant through the party. But it was also very clear to people that that the party is in serious trouble, and that there was no real solutions being provided. And what a lot of people would come up to me and say is, look, what you're doing is the right thing, but we don't really have the guts to stand up against this. And we don't have the guts to stand up against Obama. And we're going to go along with him because we're afraid of the alternative. Obama's bad, but Mitt Romney's 10 times worse. Or, you know, they would play we have to be victims of, you know, going with the lesser of two evils. And what we just made clear is that is not an option. That is a suicidal policy. And what people have to go with is the threefold solution that we've laid out, that the only option for survival right now is Glass-Steagall, Glass-Steagall, reinstatement of Glass-Steagall, a credit system, and the building of NAWPA. And that's how you're going to get people who want to actually be a part of the party again, is that there's a mission restored once again. And everybody realized, you know, you can see a real somberness in the attendees there, that there was no mission. People talked about the fact that, I mean, this is a presidential election and a presidential year, and you had less than 3,000 people attending.
Yeah, in 2008, I remember in the convention in Austin, there were over 10,000 people when it still looked like there was a fight between Hillary and Obama.
Exactly. So that's where we stand. And, you know, you got even crazier reports from the Republican convention. But the key thing right now is that there's going to have to be a real wake-up call to, and this should have sent one, to the so-called leadership of the party, that they're losing ground, and it's losing ground because they're deciding, well, we'd rather kick the population to the curb in our constituency than actually take on Obama.
Well, and I think that the people who are saying that for the most part are either trying to get in on the slush fund. They're hoping that some of the Obama campaign money will fall into their pockets. I think that's what we saw with the corrupt little weasels of the Fort Bend County Democratic Party, where they don't even have an office.
So much for that.
Yeah, but I think the more serious problem is that this brings up the question of what our nation was set up to become. It is a republic based on institutions of that represent the people. And what we've seen is the usurping of the popular will, but the people have given it away by not studying these issues, not knowing what the issues are, not understanding, for example, Glass-Steagall. And so what we talked about earlier is that you have this hyperinflation coming on, this European crash, which is inevitable if the policies being pushed now by all the leaders in Europe and Obama, if they adopt those policies of bailout and austerity, they will provoke a hyperinflationary collapse. There's no way to escape it. So that's why this question of Glass-Steagall is a matter of survival, because it's the only way to stop the bailouts. So, Keisha, in the moments we have left, you've studied this question of the credit system and Glass-Steagall. How do you get this across to people? How can our listeners go out and organize people to support a fight to get Glass-Steagall implemented?
Well, one thing is going out, what we've been doing is going out every day into the population and setting up ways of educating the population on this. And we are organizing nationally to get the population to move their Congress members. So we're calling people saying, you have to call your Congress member now and tell them to support H.R. 1489. And more, we've made this, as I said, a household name. We've set up educationals. We have classes. We have seminars. We have town hall meetings addressing, you know, right now my campaign staff, what we've been doing is working through the works of Alexander Hamilton. We're working through the National Banking Paper, working through some of the Federalist Papers. And, you know, we bring context into this, and we prepare them to be able to effectively communicate the ideas of what Glass-Steagall represents as a principle. And this going back to the foundation of our Constitution and what a real credit system is actually based on. So that's what I would recommend people do. You know, they want to get a real sense of how this works as a principle. It's one thing to understand it as a separation of banking and so forth. It's another thing to understand it as a real defeat of the British Empire. And this is what our American system of political economy represents. This is what our republic, what our Constitution was founded upon. You know, you should come into our office for, or go in, if you're not in the Texas area, go into one of the offices of our other slate of candidates, so, or anywhere in the country where we have offices, and you can actually, you know, get educated on how to actually communicate this effectively. But I'll just say what our job is going to be in the very short period ahead is we have to double, triple the number of co-sponsors on 1489, and our national slate is working tirelessly to do that. We are mobilizing every single layer, whether it's farmers, state representatives, city council members, everywhere we can. We're getting resolutions passed in support of 1489 and really setting the buzz across the country that Glass-Steagall has to be implemented immediately. So that's what we're doing.
And this corresponds with the need to get Obama out. I would recommend that people go to the LaRouche PAC website. We have, in addition to the video I mentioned of Jeff Steinberg, we're going to be covering day by day the unfolding of the scandals, the unfolding of the mobilization to bring Glass-Steagall to Europe and the United States. And I also would encourage everybody to pick up copies, to purchase copies of our new reports, the one on NWAPA 21, which gives not just the solution in terms of the nuts and bolts of the NWAPA program, but what is the method of economics that underlies this, the constitutional method. We have another new report which just came out, which is a beautiful report, and it's something that everyone out there should have in their library. It's called The British Empire's Global Showdown and How to Overcome It. And it includes some writings from Mr. LaRouche, but it also includes in-depth reports on what's happening with Russia and China. What's the war avoidance policy? Who is really running this British Empire? And what is their goal, the goal of depopulation? So these are available through LaRouche Pack, through the people you talk to in our organization, and these are reports that should be bought and then sold to others. So, and Keisha, one more time, give us your phone number and your website so people can get in touch with you and help your campaign.
Yes, that's Keisha for Congress, K-E-S-H-A for Congress.com, and the phone number again is 713-830-9052.
One more time.
713-830-9052.
And you have to stay online with LaRouchePack.com to make sure that you can provide leadership in this moment of crisis. So, Keisha, thank you very much for joining us today. I want to just say a little bit about what I'm hoping to do next week on the LaRouche Show. We have seen a series of articles by Mr. LaRouche and discussions on the weekly report on the Furtwängler principle, a reference to Wilhelm Furtwängler, the great conductor, probably the greatest classical music conductor in the 20th century, and the principle of composition and conducting that he represented, not just for music, but a way of thinking. And I hope that next week on the LaRouche Show we'll be having a roundtable discussion with people who are working on the Furtwängler principle and also have been bringing together examples that will help you discover exactly what Mr. LaRouche is talking about. So stay tuned for that. We'll probably have that next week on the LaRouche Show. Thank you for joining us today. Keisha, thank you.
Thank you.
And my thanks again to Jeff Steinberg. And the LaRouche Show is archived on the LaRouchePub.com website. It's available every week. We're here, 3 p.m. Saturday. And that's it for today. So thanks for joining us.